You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. If you missed your favorite program, don't worry. You can listen to podcasts of our program at cjsf.ca.
Canadian Philosophy Show. I am Michael Robert Kaditz. I'm here today with Brandon Brownlee and Aaron Wang, and I'll be leading today. And my topic is something I think a little different than we've been doing recently here on the Canadian Philosophy Show. And I will be following along with some research that I've been doing and a paper that I've been writing. And I want to go kind of slow because I really want to methodically go through the various premises that I'm working with and go over some of the research that I've done. I am going to start out in the spirit of the conventional philosophy paper and give you my thesis statement, sort of where I'm going right at the outset. And then I'll back up and begin laying the groundwork for where I'm going from the very beginning. So we'll be assuming no knowledge that anyone has, right? No, I won't be presupposing that anyone accepts any of my premises or has any background knowledge on this. The general topic is evolution, but more specifically, I'm going to be looking into biological or genetic evolution, sometimes referred to as natural selection. And I'm also going to be looking into cultural evolution, which is, I think, a cutting-edge discipline. It is not nearly as developed. Cultural evolution and the concept of cultural evolution is not nearly as developed or as settled a matter as, for many people, natural selection is, or Darwinian evolution. So there is still a lot of controversy and research being done around cultural evolution. So I'm going to go a little bit into my research on the state of the discipline right now vis-a-vis cultural evolution. I promised that I would give you my thesis. So where I'm going with this, and it may be the next episode, is I am laying down a case for the reducibility of cultural evolution to biological evolution. I think it's a fairly uncommon and probably highly controversial thesis that I have, but I'm going to lay the case, lay the groundwork, and I'm not going to be definitive. I'm going to be trying to be very open-minded about this, and I'm going to admit when I'm not sure, and I'm going to admit when things are possible and worthy of more research. And in fact, I will admit that my entire thesis is worthy of more research, and it's not a strong definitive claim I'm making, but I'm opening up the possibility with, I think, a reasonable, justifiable case that cultural evolution is nothing more than biological evolution. I want to start at the very beginning. As I said, I don't want to assume any premises. So the very first premise in my thesis is going to be that there is change that occurs. That might seem self-evident to a lot of people, but not to everyone. Not to everyone. And I'm not sure where you guys, my co-hosts, are at with this, but I am totally open to this and any of my premises being challenged. Even if it's not your own view, at least bring up the opposing views if perhaps I don't know what they are. So I want to be truly kind of Socratic in my presentation here and take on any opposing arguments that either you guys bring up or that I come across in my research. So it's not necessary that change even occurs biologically. And we have various examples of, especially from medieval times, from theologians and religious philosophers who have made alternate claims that, for example, that God created the world as we see it today, that when we see distinct species of animals, when we see human beings, that God created these distinct species. They didn't develop from something else. There was no change involved. The world is as God created it. That's one alternate view to the idea that there's even change happening in the biological world, or perhaps even in the cultural world. The world is as God created it. Variations on that, which there's the intelligent design variation, which is that God created the world to look like there was change. So whatever evolution we have empirical evidence for, that Darwin claimed to have evidence for, sure, that evidence is there, but it does not imply actual evolution, but rather it implies creation to look like there was evolution for some reason.
Yeah, I don't know how much this will go into sort of setting up a critique or a defense of a static being or something like that. But I've always understood the premise of Darwinian natural selection to be the problematization of the earlier way of thinking, which might have to do with something like a creationist argument and whatnot. But before Darwin, largely the variety of beings that there were, and we're talking about biological beings, was considered essential. There were fixed types. And along comes Darwin and says, actually, what we call species are not ontological kinds. Variation occurs. And it's not so... It has to do with the fact that, yes, variation occurs over time, but that there is no essential distinction if change occurs over time. I wish I could, you know, I wish I was a proficient Parmenidean and I could defend static monism. I think that would be fun, but I'm just putting forward my understanding of, because you're basing this on a Darwinian picture, and this is the problematization that the Darwinian picture puts forward. It's that not only do species change over time, but because species change over time, the distinction between them is not essential in the way that, you know, an Aristotelian might say, okay, there is the substance of a fox, there is the substance of a horse, etc. There aren't essential metaphysical kinds. There is, I guess, a running together in this evolutionary process.
My goal here is not to prove that the Darwinian concept of evolution is correct. I'm laying the groundwork, and actually in a few minutes here, I'm just going to say that for my purposes, I'm assuming that creationist views, intelligent design views of the world are not correct, or at least they're not going to be the basis. I'm going to have to exclude those to pursue my theory. Before I go on to that, though, I just want to mention the various iterations of what sometimes is called the jeweler's watch argument. There's various names for it. There's an argument that was predominant belief before Darwin, which is that the complexity of the world is just too great and too unlikely to have occurred such that an eye can see, unless there was a creator that designed eyes. And examples were given where a telescope is created by people and works in a very similar way to the human eye. So humans created a telescope. And by analogy, therefore, and this is one type of argument, right? By analogy, analogical inference. By analogy, if a telescope was created, then a human eye must have also been created and couldn't have just developed haphazardly. And that's a variation of the jeweler's watch argument. The jeweler's watch argument also can take the form of the amazing intricacy of the universe. You know, it's just so unlikely to have happened by chance. It couldn't have happened by chance. Everything had to fall into place in a certain way. And it's just completely unrealistic to think that everything just fell into place without an intelligent designer having created it. So without addressing those arguments specifically, that's too far, you know, a field from where I want to go. I just want to acknowledge those arguments, and I want to acknowledge that for the purposes of my thesis, I'm going to be accepting, contra many of those arguments, those traditional arguments, I'm going to be asserting and accepting the initial premise that change is happening that's not directed by an intelligent designer, that there's change that's happening for various reasons other than intentionality by some intelligent being or God or something like that. And so that would apply to biological change. And it's also going to apply to cultural change. So, yeah, so it's self-evident to some people, and I'm sure there are other people who don't accept that premise that there's change. But I'm acknowledging that that's a premise of my theory. So if we accept, for my purposes at least, for the purposes of this discussion and this pursuit, that there's change happening, and historically there's always been change happening on the earth biologically, then the question is, what is the nature of this change? And I haven't gotten yet to natural selection. I haven't gotten to genetic change, because we can't assume that all change that happens would be a result of genetic change or natural selection. So I wanted to talk about two concepts, which I'm actually borrowing from medieval times, from the scholastics. Aquinas talked about, and also Edward Fraser, a contemporary philosopher, they talked about the distinction between two types of causal chains, per accident and per se. So they're sort of perhaps archaic terms for concepts that are actually very important, I think. I think the best way to distinguish between per accident and per se causal chains would be by giving examples. A per accident causal chain would be where, for example, a grandson's existence is not dependent on his grandfather's continued action or existence. So once the grandson is born, the grandfather may not be alive anymore, may not be around, but the grandson exists. So in that type of family lineage, once someone is born, that person's father, grandfather, mother, they don't have to exist anymore for that child to exist and to have a life. That's a per accidents causal chain. The initial cause doesn't have to keep on producing this stimulus for the effect to be realized. Now, that's the type of causal chain that did not work well with the argument for God. Because the argument for God made in medieval times, one of the arguments for God, one of St. Thomas Aquinas's proofs for the existence of God, had to do with the fact that nothing could keep happening if there wasn't a prime mover continuing to produce the effect. So God needed to keep on doing what God was doing in order for the world to continue to exist. Now, that type of causal chain that I just described is the per se causal chain. So the per se causal chain is a causal chain where the initial stimulus, the initial cause, needs to be maintained for the entire chain to exist. So an example of that would be a hand is holding a stick, and the stick moves a rock, and the rock moves the leaf. Well, if the hand drops the stick, then the whole causal chain collapses, and all the second causes cease to happen. So that type of causal chain, the per se causal chain, is the type that the scholastics like St. Thomas Aquinas argued explains the universe. That God must be continuing with intention to design the universe, to intend for the universe to continue, otherwise the universe would collapse. So the fact that the universe is here, that things are happening, there's movement happening, the intricacies are working, we can see, we can live, proves that God exists. So how does this distinction between per accidents and per se causal chains relate to biological change? Well, the question is, if an event occurs which has an effect on species, the question is, when the event is over, do the species return to normal the way they were, or have they been forever changed? So if there's an event and it has an impact on species, the question is, do the offspring, do subsequent generations of that species feel the effects? Are they going to have the effects, bear the effects of that, say, one-off event? Does the species remain unchanged? Does it bounce back to the way it was? So this speaks to whether or not we can talk about natural selection and evolution, which is intergenerational.
Yeah, so I think that essentially this echoes the idea of heritable and non-heritable traits. That's something that I think as we get deeper into the argument, it'll be interesting to discuss how that varies in terms of biological or Darwinian evolution versus cultural evolution, because the types of things that are heritable or pass from one generation to the next generation are distinctly different, and so then the mechanisms which we might consider may be different. And this is something that I'm not sure how to filter into this discussion, but I think like one of the groundbreaking moments for me in understanding the theory of evolution was when I realized that the theory or the concept of evolution is fundamentally abstract. And in that sense, it's not, the concept of evolution itself is not necessarily falsifiable, because your mechanisms of natural selection don't necessarily mean the exact same mechanisms for species in different times and in different places. Natural selection is abstract enough to encompass multiple factors in multiple environments. So, and how a species change will just depend on what processes allow it to change, and different species are capable of changing in different ways. So the theory has to account for that. So that's, I mean, yeah, just another piece of complexity, I think, for this that we'll probably get into eventually.
Right. And I haven't even gotten to natural selection yet, because I'm really trying to elaborate on some of the basic ideas of how change happens. So I wanted to give a few examples of what I'm calling per se causal chains, per se causal events. So again, per se events would be that the first cause must continue for the entire causal chain to exist. That as soon as the first cause stops, or the event or the stimulus stops, then the entire causal chain stops. And then we could say that things sort of return back to the way they were before that event occurred. You might guess that's not what natural selection suggests, but I'm trying to offer an alternate view or alternate examples of how change can happen. Change can happen in a biological community, which we do not need to talk about natural selection or evolution when we talk about that change. So I want to give a few examples of that. Let's talk about environmental events. So you could have like a weather event, extreme weather event, temperature and humidity patterns that, let's say even if it's entire season, so let's say you have an El Nino year or a very hot, dry season or very cold season, that could be a one-off. I mean, in fact, it's normal to have abnormal seasons, right? Every year is slightly different weather-wise in a particular location. But if you had, a very extreme season, that might affect multiple generations of insects, for example, that only live for several weeks. So there's mosquitoes that live 5 weeks. Their lifespan is 5 weeks. And then they have offspring, and they have offspring. So there'd be multiple generations of mosquitoes that would exist over one weather season. So there you could have multiple generations affected by a weather event or weather conditions, but that would be a per se causal chain, because as soon as the weather condition is over or the season's over, it's no longer impacting those mosquitoes. But it did impact multiple generations while the initial cause was happening. Another way that you could have intergenerational change biologically would be through something that's called epigenetics, which is another fairly new and controversial field, which is that there's in utero exposure to maternal distress, which can cause or negatively affect the maturation of the prefrontal and subcortical neural circuits in a fetus. So if that's true, if that really happens, then trauma experienced by a parent or particularly by a mother could affect the brains of the offspring. But that wouldn't be true for multiple generations beyond that. It would just be for the next generation. But nonetheless, you would have a non-genetic, it's not a natural selection process, it's simply damage to the fetus caused by an event that originates with the mother. So it's an example of an intergenerational impact that we don't need to explain. We don't need natural selection or genetic mutation to explain that. So I just wanted to give several examples of how you could have intergenerational effects, but they're in a per se fashion, which is that the cause must be there for those effects to continue. When the cause is gone, then there is a sort of recovery. It was important for me to illustrate that because I want to contrast that with the per accident causal chain, which is now what we're talking about when we approach evolution, what we normally mean when we talk about natural selection and genetic evolution, Darwinian evolution. Now, just one word of caution. Darwinian evolution is not the correct term when we talk about genetics, because Darwin didn't know about genes. Darwin didn't know about DNA and genes and all that. He, nonetheless, through observation, provided evidence for natural selection, but it wasn't until later that the actual method, the vehicle by which this occurs, which would be genetic mutation, random genetic mutation, was known. But Darwin, nonetheless, picked up empirically what's happening, the natural selection. I wanted to talk about how evolutionary change happens without re-exposure or continuation of the original stimulus. So the per accidents causal chain, where the initial cause, the first cause, the initial stimulus could be gone, and yet the effect is now permanent or persistent, is a building block towards continued change. when we talk about this, we're talking about evolution. So there's a couple necessary premises when we talk about evolution, or we could say that evolution implies at least these two claims. The first one is that intergenerational changes are innate. So offspring innately carry in them the change that happened previously. So offspring do not acquire these changes via perception or exposure to the original stimulus. The change that's happened is now become innate, has become innate in offspring. Offspring have no choice, and it doesn't matter whether they're exposed or not to whatever the thing that caused the change, or the adaptation, or the environmental pressure, or the environmental occurrences. They could still be completely gone, those initial stimuli, but the offspring still bears innately the previous effects of that development. The second implication when we talk about evolution is there needs to be a vehicle for propagation of the changes from one generation to the next. Darwin didn't know what that was. Now we know it's genes, biologically, right? Genes. And genes, of course, are segments of DNA. And genes determine the biological, the physical characteristics of offspring. That's the vehicle. So evolution requires those two things. It requires this per accident causal chain, where the initial cause doesn't need to be there anymore. And then it requires that offspring innately possess the biological changes that have happened up to this point in that type of organism or in that species.
And that is distinct from per se causes, or would you say that that innate structure is, in a sense, the innate carryover, would you say that works like a per se cause in the offspring? Like, because it's carrying over the effects of prior causes?
If the DNA, if genes carry with them the properties and characteristics of an individual in that species, then that individual possesses innately those characteristics. There's no relearning necessary. There's no re-exposure to stimuli. There's no sense perception involved. It doesn't matter what that individual's experience or perceptions are, that individual is going to have innately those characteristics that have been propagated through genes, through DNA. It doesn't matter if the original cause is there. So that I'm saying is a per accidents causal chain, a per accidents. The grandson's existence is not dependent on the grandfather's continued existence. My characteristics, which were genetically transmitted to me, are not dependent upon my being re-exposed to whatever the original stimulus was for those characteristics developing in my species, right? So I don't need to be re-exposed to the environmental pressures that caused me to have two arms. I'm born with two arms. So, you know, it's contrary to medieval religious thought that God needs to continually, you know, provoke what we witness here, what we see, the way we are in the universe. And if God stops doing it, we'll all disappear. So I'm trying to lay some theoretical foundation for what evolution implies. This is one of the reasons why it's objectionable to some religious people who believe that God is orchestrating everything. The idea that things can just happen on their own without God's hand in the picture continuously is objectionable and counter to Christian theology, in my view. You are listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I am slowly going through my research on evolution. It's going to be also cultural evolution later on. I am Michael Robert Kaditz. I'm here with Brandon Brownlee and Aaron Wang. So what are some of the concepts when we talk about biological evolution? And I'm slowly going to get to what we all think of, which is natural selection, genetic mutation, and that sort of thing. But first, I want to talk about some of the concepts. So there's mutation. There's something called genetic drift. There's gene flow. and there's non-random mating, and then finally there's natural selection.